This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And today we reveal some amazing prices for spectacular items. There's lots about museums and galleries, a lovely story of foiled thieves, and a question you might be able to help with. But firstly, love is in the air. What price love? What would you pay for a Valentine's card? And if golf is your love, what price a golf ball? Taxidermy? How about a 5-foot penis? Finally, a lovely story about Australian jewellery. Stay tuned, and we start with St. Valentine's. This piece comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of February, 2019, page 10. Valentine card sells on Valentine's Day. One of the world's oldest Valentine cards sold for £5,800, appropriately on February the 14th. Dated to circa 1790 to 1810, it went under the hammer at Hanson's at Etwall, Derbyshire, estimated at £200 to £300. It was won by phone bidder Jackie Brown, the editor and co-owner of London's Progressive Greetings, a trade magazine for the greetings card industry. She will add it to her collection that includes the first commercially produced Christmas card that Sir Henry Cole published in 1843. The Valentine sold for around £7,000 once the 20% premium is added, and that's approximately $12,500. It was found among a collection of around 200 mainly Victorian and Georgian greetings cards, which belonged to the late Lawrence Randall, a keen philatelist and card collector, who died in 2009. It is addressed to Anne at Hartwell House in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire. And that came from the Antiques Trade Gazette. Happy Valentine's Day. And now for a very different sort of love. A love of golf, and this has a New Zealand connection. And this also comes from page 10 of the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of February. Early golf ball hits £5,000 at auction. More bogeys than birdies have emerged in the difficult golfiana market of late, but on January the 30th, a rare Robertson feather-filled ball took a top estimate £5,000, plus 20% buyer's premium, at Mullock's of Church Stretton. Consigned for sale from a vendor in New Zealand, it was bought by an Italian collector. The Robertson family of St. Andrews made feather balls from the 1720s until the 1850s, when the cheaper gutta-percha ball became dominant. Alan Robertson, 1815 to 1859, was recognised as the best ball maker of his generation and among the finest players. His death at 44 prompted the launch of the Open Golf Championship to establish who would succeed him as the champion golfer. However, this ball with the handwritten weight 28 was probably made by his father, William, circa 1820. Back in 2004, a ball made by William Robertson sold for £24,000 at Lion and Turnbull. Now that's really quite a score. Let's change from tees and fairways to taxidermy. And we have a photograph here in the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of February of a gentleman smiling and holding what looks like a giant carrot. But the heading is, "No, it isn't a huge carrot." It's not every day you see an auctioneer holding a 5'6", that's 1.67 metre, long sperm whale penis. Then again, it's not every day that you see the sort of lots that are offered in Sorders Out of the Ordinary auction. The format was launched at the Essex Sale Room in February last year by Mark Wilkinson, who's pictured, who also started Christie's Interior Sales and Bonham's Important Design Series. The latest sale, held on February the 12th at Stansted Mount Fitchett, presented another mind-boggling 415-lot selection. The late 19th century taxidermy stuffed sperm whale penis, Physeter macrocephalus, stuffed with hair and end tied with rope, was one of the best performers of the day out of the more antique objects. Measuring 11.5 inches, that's 29 centimetres, at the thickest part, it sold for £4,600, plus 23% buyer's premium, against an estimate of £3,500 to £4,500. The catalogue noted, "The vendor of this item has received an email from the UK CITES Management Authority, and this piece has been classed as worked and does not require an Article 10 certificate. May be subject to CITES regulations when exported." Taxidermy is a strong feature of the auction, and top price was paid for a late 20th century full-mounted taxidermy Canadian polar bear, Ursus maritimus, mounted on a rocky base, 7 foot 7, that's 2.3 metres high, sold for a low estimate £20,000. The sale hammer total was £231,000. Thank you, Antique Trade Gazette. If you thought sledging was something done on the cricket field, think again. What does it have to do with English public schools? Well, the Antique Trade Gazette tells us on the 16th of February, "Leading sledge Antarctic relic takes £115,000. A sledge from the first expedition to the Antarctic, led by Ernest Shackleton, sold for £115,000 in Bonham's Travel and Exploration sale on February the 6th. It was entered for sale by Monkton Coombe School, the alma mater of Eric Marshall, 1879 to 1963, who was the expedition ship Nimrod's surgeon, cartographer and photographer. Marshall, 1879 to 1963, a medic, rower and rugby player, met Shackleton at a party in 1906 and volunteered for the expedition on the spot. The two men did not always see eye to eye. Marshall's diaries frequently expressed irritation, and much later he would call his boss the biggest mountebank of the century. However, Shackleton chose Marshall alongside Jamison Adams and Frank Wild to undertake the four-man march to the South Pole. Although the quartet had to abandon the attempt in January 1907, they were within 100 geographical miles of the pole and, at the time, the furthest south ever travelled. The sledge proved a superior form of transport than others chosen for the expedition. One of the Nimrod sponsors was the Arrol Johnston Motor Company, whose four-cylinder, 15-horsepower air-cooled car was untested in the situation, much less demanding than Antarctica. A total of 18, 11-foot, that's 3.36-metre, long ash and hickory sledges of the Nansen pattern were purchased from L.H. Hagen and Company for the expedition. Shackleton favoured the size as the best for general work, for it was not so long as to be unwieldy and at the same time was long enough to ride over sastrugi and hammocky ice. They were pulled by ponies that gradually succumbed to the conditions. Estimated at £60,000 to £100,000, the sledge was the subject of competition from bidders in the room, on the phone and on the internet. A sledge flag, also from Monkton Coombe School, which received their donation from Marshall in 1952, sold for a further £60,000. A 25% buyer premium was charged. A number of other Nimrod sledges are known, including seven in the Museum of New Zealand that were brought to New Zealand in 1917 with the rescued men of the Ross Sea Party and sold at auction in Wellington in March of that year. And that was written by Roland Arkell in the Antiques Trade Gazette. How does a whole lot of Goldfields jewellery come to be sold in England? Well, Goldfields jewellery was often purchased as souvenirs, and not surprisingly it found its way back to the old Dart. And here's an article from the Antiques Trade Gazette of the 16th of February. Wizards of Oz, and it's written by Roland R. Kell. Gold Rush era jewellery from Down Under is a rare visitor to UK sales rooms, but remarkably several pieces have appeared for sale in recent months. The distinctive Antipodean jewellery of the Gold Rush era is among the first to depict the native flora and fauna of the continent. It's of huge cultural significance to Australia and its mining heritage. Pieces of botanical jewellery can be found in the Powerhouse Museum, Sydney, the National Gallery of Victoria, Melbourne, the Queensland Art Gallery in Brisbane, and the National Library of Australia, Canberra. 1.5 centuries of economic and social history ensures pieces are occasionally appear for sale in the UK. By coincidence, several have been sold in recent months. The Sydney firm of Hogarth, Erickson & Co. pioneered the style. Julius Hogarth, a die sinker and silversmith born in Copenhagen, reached Sydney in the César Godefroy in December 1852. Conrad Erickson, a Norwegian engraver, was another passenger on the ship. The pair were awarded a bronze medal at the 1854 Sydney Colonial Exhibition for a brooch decorated in intricate three-dimensional detail with an Aboriginal figure, an emu and a kangaroo, the earliest known piece of this type. Few pieces with a definitive connection to Hogarth and Erickson and Co. are known, only a handful are marked or come in original boxes. The brooch offered by Fellows, with 23% buyer's premium, on January the 24th, was of sufficient quality to tempt bidders to make an attribution. Alex Duffy, Fellows jeweller specialist, described it as a beautifully crafted example of Australian colonial jewellery. The piece garnered a lot of interest before the sale, and against an estimate of £500 to £700, hammered at £7,300. It was bought by an Australian internet buyer using thesaleroom.com against two phones and bidders in the room. Many Australian jewellers emulated Hogarth and Erickson's work in the 1850s and 1860s. A Gold Rush-era brooch, circa 1860, sold for an unprecedented £2,800 at Truro Auction House, Lodge & Thomas, with 15% buyer's premium, on September the 28th. This brooch, depicting a typical display of a kangaroo, ostrich and possums, was not of the same quality, but the buyer was again an internet bidder on thesaleroom.com, paying a high multiple of the £100 to £150 estimate. A variant on the theme is the Gold Prospector's brooch, typically combining marsupials, palms and grasses, with gold pans, shovels, pickaxes, gold nuggets. Some pieces were created for sale in South Africa and California in the wake of the 1849 and all that. The final sale held at George Kidner in Lymington on January the 10th, the auction has now closed, included a typical example comprising a kangaroo standing on a panel of gold nuggets within a grapevine border. It was stamped on the reverse WL between symbols of a bird and crown. This brooch sold for £2,000. Completing a sweep of prices for Australian Gold Rush jewellery back in 2016, Chorleys of Prinknash Abbey Park offered three pieces that came by direct descent from Hugh Hamilton, 1822 to 1900, a New South Wales cattle rancher turned gold commissioner. A brooch in a fitted case for Hogarth and Erickson and Co. sold for £14,000, while an elaborate openwork bracelet bearing the mark of the goldsmith and topographical photographer Christian Ludwig Quist, 1818 to 1877, took a mighty £57,000. Quist worked for Hogarth and Erickson just before their 1861 bankruptcy, and it's likely that the oxidised silver figure of emu, kangaroo and aborigine that populated the bracelet would have been supplied by Julius Hogarth circa 1863 to 1865. And that was Wizards of Oz, written by Roland R. Kell. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And let's move now to museums and galleries. And I think this is a really moving piece. It's really touched some strings. This comes from the ArtNet News from news.artnet.com. And it was from Javier Pesch on February the 18th, 2019, titled, "As a new Rembrandt show opens, the Dutch charity is bringing terminally ill patients to see it. The Rijksmuseum show, All the Rembrandts, will mean even more demand to pay a final visit to the institution." It comes with a picture of a terminally ill patient viewing a painting. "There's a remarkable Dutch charity that helps those with the dying wish to visit the Rijksmuseum fulfill their dreams. And when the Amsterdam institution last organised a major Rembrandt show, it saw more requests than ever." Kees Veldboer, the founder of the charity Ambulance Wish Foundation, which has organised more than 50 trips for terminally ill patients to the Rijksmuseum, expects even more people will want to see the new exhibition of 400 works by Dutch master All the Rembrandts, which marks the 350th anniversary of the artist's death, than they did during the museum's popular 2015 show Late Rembrandts. "The blockbuster exhibition, which brings together all of Rembrandt's works in the collection of the Dutch National Art Museum, opened to the public this past weekend. There were 22 paintings among the 400 works in the once-in-a-lifetime exhibition, which largely features drawings and prints. By comparison, Late Rembrandt, which the Rijksmuseum co-organised with London's National Gallery, featured 40 paintings, many on loan. The charity is busy year-round. It grants 5 or 6 people's wishes a day," says Veldboer, who launched the organisation with his wife Ineke, who is a nurse, more than a decade ago. "Each guest gets a teddy bear named after the first person Veldboer helped, an old sailor who wanted to see Rotterdam Harbour one last time. The dying person's special visit from their home, hospital or hospice is overseen by a trained nurse, while the ambulances are driven by specialist volunteers. One driver, Roald Foppen, took a photograph of a woman lying on an ambulance stretcher looking at Rembrandt's self-portrait as an old man. In 2015, he told the BBC that he took the photograph at the same time that he was with another person whose dying wish was also to see the exhibition, someone who had been a regular museum visitor," Foppen recalled. "Many people's dying wish is to see their home, the sea, or visit the zoo for one last time. Visits to museums typically take place after the institution has closed to the public. Ambulance Wish's most recent visit to the Rijksmuseum was in December," Veldboer says. Veldboer has also taken a recent visit to the nearby Van Gogh Museum with one terminally ill patient. I find that story really rather moving, and I think that's an absolutely superb charity to have. And staying with museums and moving back to Australia, let's quick march to the State Library in Macquarie Street, Sydney. If you want to see a good exhibition, here's one. "Precious Unseen Letters to Dear Old Dad Capture World War I Experience for Children." And I'm going to read part of the media release of this splendid exhibition. "I've started a washer for you and I hope it will be all right and will be nice and soft for your face. What I use to kiss at night." Frank Burrows, 6. The State Library of New South Wales' latest exhibition offers a rare, intimate view into the lives of children whose fathers served in the First World War. According to the State Library curator, Elise Edmonds, "Rarely is the war experience told through the eyes, or, in this case, the words of children. Their heartfelt letters to their fathers, filled with simple everydayness of their lives, will have many reaching for the tissues. Quick March, the Children of World War I gives a voice to those who left to keep the home fires burning, expressed through a selection of children's letters, drawings and homemade cards, as well as photographs, art books, badges and an original 1919 peace flag, many on public display for the first time. The exhibition centres around the Burrows family from Rooty Hill in Sydney's west. Arthur John, Bill Burrows, a professional soldier, initially based at the Liverpool military training camp, served in the trenches of France, where he was wounded in mid-1918. His children, Ruth, 8, and Frank, 6, sent him sweet, funny letters where they told him all the news from home, drew lots of pictures, and shared jokes together, said Elise. These poignant letters were often addressed to Dear Old Dad or Dear Old Daddy, and were filled with hugs and kisses. The letters were cherished so much that Bill kept them with him, even in the trenches. Exhibition visitors can experience what home life was like for children during the war, like Ruth and Frank, step inside a World War I-era living room and enjoy a beautiful soundscape imagining their day-to-day life created by scriptwriter Hilary Bell and performed by actors from the Australian Theatre for Young People, that's ATYP. Young visitors can play Catch the Kaiser at the dining table and dress up in nurses' and soldiers' uniforms, like Ruth and Frank would have done. Quick March also highlights how children contributed to the war effort by knitting and fundraising, the books they were reading at school, often about bravery and sacrifice, and the peace marches of 1919. And this exhibition, Quick March, The Children of World War I, is free and at the State Library of New South Wales in Macquarie Street from the 16th of March to the 6th of October. And you can get details from the State Library's website on www.sl.nsw.gov.au/gallery. Now, just a quick reminder of your orders. Quick March down to the State Library. Let's move now to auctioneers. They have a little bit of a problem at viewing time prior to the auction, when there are many people wishing to handle and look at items, some of course out of curiosity, some wishing to bid, and there can be accidents and problems. And here's quite an amusing letter that came from Nicholas Skeeping, and it was written to the Antiques Trade Gazette on the 2nd of March. My world came crashing down. Madam, further to handling horror stories, I can remember visiting a general sale at W.H. Lane Auction House in Penzance in the early 1970s, when all sales were general and spying an interesting painting high up on the wall was given permission to climb up and see it. Unfortunately, I knocked a bit of a horse harness off the wall, which crashed onto a table full of crockery, with disastrous results. Don't worry, said Tom Lugg, the excellent general manager there for many years. I'll sweep it all up and put it in the bin where it belongs anyway. Phew! Wonderful instant appraisal by Tom, and a lesson learned by me. I doubt I'd get off so lightly these days, regardless of the value, wrote Nicholas Skeeping in the Antiques Trade Gazette. And now here's another close shave. This is reported in the Sydney Morning Herald of Saturday the 16th of March. Thieves fooled into stealing fake Bruegel. I rather like this one. A gang of thieves who thought they'd stolen a painting by Peter Bruegel the Younger from a church in Italy actually took a fake deliberately planted by police. The thieves stole The Crucifixion by the Flemish painter from a parish church in Castelnuovo Magra in northwestern region of Liguria on Wednesday. But they were unaware police had received intelligence the oil painting, estimated to be worth around €3 million, might be at risk of being stolen and had been replaced the original with a replica. Police also set up surveillance cameras around the church and are now studying the footage in an attempt to identify the culprits. The theft of the painting was widely reported by the Italian media on Wednesday, but it was only later that the police revealed that the stolen masterpiece was not the real thing. The town's mayor was in on the subterfuge, telling media outlets the loss of the Bruegel was a hard blow for our community. The thieves had pulled up in front of the Santa Maria Maddalena church in a white Peugeot at lunchtime before using a hammer to break open a display case and make off with the painting at high speed. They were spotted by a woman who lives opposite the church, who raised the alarm and called the mayor, Daniele Pontebello. It gradually emerged that the stolen object was a fake, with the original placed in safekeeping. The original painting was replaced by a copy more than a month ago, said the mayor. We were hearing rumours that someone wanted to steal it, so the Carabinieri, Italy's paramilitary police force, brought in the fake and installed security cameras. The original Bruegel, which measures 43 by 67 centimetres, was stolen from the church nearly 40 years ago, but was recovered. It's a copy of a work by the artist's father, Peter Bruegel the Elder. And that piece actually came from London, and it appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald Saturday the 16th of March. I think that's rather a good story with rather a good ending. And now here's the question I have for you. Let's talk about timepieces, clocks, watches, and what have you. Up until the mid-17th century, clocks generally had one hand. Have a look at the Paston treasure painting, which we use on our 2RPH website to highlight this Antiques Radio Show programme. Try going to www.2rph.org.au. Have a look at the Paston treasure painting and look at the clock on the right-hand side. It has only one hand. Two hands came in with pendulums and improved technology. But however many hands, they all went around the same way. So here's the question. How did Julius Caesar order his legion to circle the Britons anti-clockwise and attack from behind? And how did King Arthur tell his knights to arrange themselves clockwise around the table? Both events were before mechanical clocks existed. Oh, and by the way, if you think that Widdershins is the answer, W-I-D-D-E-R-S-H-I-N-S, which is apparently a lowland Scottish term, that's unfortunately early 16th century and is a bit too late. And if you come across the word deosil, which is, I believe, a Gaelic word, that may help, but I have a feeling it may be too late as well. Anyway, if you've got any alternative and know how to advise Julius Caesar or King Arthur, I'd be very happy to know. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.